There are not many things that shut me down, to be honest with you, because in my mind, there are a couple of things that motivate me, that keep me from shutting down. One is that I don't have a right to shut down. When people shut down, I think it's a luxury that they afford themselves. And I don't knock people when they have to take a break, because I don't think anybody can go without taking a break. But for us to decide, as privileged as we are in a world where there's so much pain and suffering, and that we, even without suffering in the United States, have more privilege than most people on the planet, I think that there are just far too many privileges that we have, first and foremost, to just take the luxury of saying that I'm not going to try to do anything about this world that we live in. I think that, you know, from a spiritual point of view, that we all were born into a certain destiny to do things to help make this world a better place. There are lots of people who have gone before us who have dealt with this world trying to make a difference when they had a lot less to work with than we do. You know, you look at people like Ella Baker, or you look at, you know, the Malcolms and the Martins and the Sojourner Truths. I have a light plate switch over my, a light plate cover in my bedroom. And I bought that thing because I thought this is how you contextualize this work. It says that sometimes I get so tired and then I remember what Harriet Tubman did for a living. And when you consider that there are tons of people who have gone before us, who have made it possible for us to be where we are, then it's just that we're one in a line of people who are supposed to be doing things to keep this world going and to bring some kind of justice and balance into the world. And so even when I find myself getting down, usually it's because I'm tired, I feel overwhelmed by the circumstances, but it doesn't take long before I can break it apart and say, what is it that's overwhelming me? What is it I can do something about? What is it I can find somebody else to help me do something about? And what is it that I got to let go of? Because it's not mine to deal with right now. And usually once I can break it apart, find some part that I can deal with, once I take a few steps, it opens up my vision about what's possible and what I can do, as well as other people who can help, you know, play a part in it. So suffering around me, the suffering and the injustice motivates the heck out of me. Because, I mean, and it does get overwhelming, but I'm telling you that fundamentally nothing will change if we are not working to make a change, you know. And I tell you this, the hardest part is making decisions that, I don't know, making decisions about how you're going to approach the work so that you're more and more effective. And I'm saying that partly because I was thinking about a conversation I had the other day. I think it's a serious issue to think about how you're going to approach work with diverse groups of people. And I'm saying that, I'm not even trying to avoid saying what I want to say. I want to contextualize what I'm about to say. As I look at what's happening to African American people in this country right now and all over this planet, looking at how people of color are treated, and I think about the challenge of working with white people to challenge the racism, the fundamental white supremacy that operates on this planet, that there are times when I have come to the conclusion, and it's a very difficult conclusion, that there are times when black folks and people of color can't work with white folks. Because the compromise that is required when you're working with whites who have not reconciled the privilege they experience in this system and the reality of this white supremacy, I can't get into the mind of whites who are justice-minded, who are not willing to do whatever is necessary to truly dismantle this system in a way that eliminates the privilege that's built in, the inherent privilege that's built in for some and not for others. And the thing that's so bizarre to me is that we get so caught up into the racism that people end up supporting things that are not in their own interest to maintain the privilege that they think that they have or that they feel that they have. And so fundamentally, just trying to think about who it is you're going to choose to work with and what priorities you set in terms of who you work with and how you work with them. Knowing that fundamentally in my heart, I believe that if we don't all work together, we're going to all perish together. But knowing that at each time you got a limited amount of time and a limited amount of resources, and who are the people that you find most strategic at a given point.
All right, let me flip the tape here. Yeah, you know, Ann Braden just died this week. Did you see that?
Oh, Lord, no.
Isn't that a loss for
people
of color, for white people? Trying to,
God, I didn't know that. Oh, sure. God, I'm so sad to hear that. I knew her back in my Kentucky days, and I always liked her. God, I always liked her. Where was she living?
In the Northwest, maybe? I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I haven't seen her in a lot of years, but that is, you know what? Let me tell you something. We got to step to the plate in a real way, because I'm telling you that we are losing a lot of folk. People who I wasn't as pleased at this point, and, you know, some of this stuff has gotten so bougie. But just to think about a whole era. I mean, Ossie Davis and a whole lot of these activists. Even Rosa Parks, I mean, she ushered in an era. People, you know, talked about that forever, but it was the whole era just leaving up out of here, girl, and we got to step to the plate in a real way.
Who do you think? Do you think that there are some leaders like that who are really doing kind of radical...
Girl, please close this thing up. I'll be eating this thing. That is empty shit.
You're eating these peanuts. They're good for you. Lots of protein.
Thank God. I mean, I think I'm one of them kind of leaders. I think other people are. I think that we just operate in a different climate, a different context, different kinds of challenges. But the reality is we absolutely need folks to be ready to take some risk to do stuff different. And we can't be worried about trying to be politically correct, because it makes the difference in whether or not people die or live. When I consider right now the fact that they are about to eliminate Roe v. Wade, and that we saw it coming, the fact that we live in a time where there are no checks and balances on our government, that the Democratic Party is the other side of the Republican Party, their interests are primarily corporate interests and the interests of the wealthy, and that because we don't have an alternative to that moneyed corporate interest, so much of what meets the needs of the masses of the people is not going to be in place with a conservative Supreme Court, a conservative Congress, and then a conservative presidency. And because political process has become so disengaged from real people, to me it's something sick about the fact that people expect that the masses of people in the community are going to be going to the polls to vote for folks who they know are not getting ready to do anything for them. And so it's totally disingenuous to think that somehow you're going to motivate people to go to the polls and you're not putting a new agenda forward that speaks to how things are going to be different. In the absence of that, it's not enough to forewarn people of doom and gloom when they operate in an environment where they're struggling with survival. The doom and gloom is already here for them. And they don't have a clue that things can get a whole lot worse. And it can. So I just think that there are a number of us who could do better than we're doing, because we need to take more risks. There are those of us who are doing a number of things and they just don't get the visibility. I mean, there are a number of people out here, but they don't have the access to the mediums that would make people, to help people hear those voices in a mass way. I think that there are so many of us, like, I'm not sure. In some ways, I think that the nonprofit sector has been a wonderful thing because of the kind of services provided to the community. In the other hand, there's a way that these infrastructures has given people a way to create their own entity to address community problems that prevented them or kept them from forcing themselves to have to come together in a way that they would have to partner on things. That if you get your own nonprofit and you can raise your own grants and you can survive and have a job, have income, and got a focus, there's just too much splintering in our community that I think is helped by being able to set up a nonprofit. It keeps you from having to force yourself to reconcile your differences so that you can build a mass base that's unified. So, I don't know. The thing that that I feel fairly certain about is that things are going to have to get a lot worse before they get better. And there's going to have to be a lot more suffering. And I think that's tragic. But it seems to be human nature that until enough people are hurting and there's some common analysis about that pain, that people don't get the sense that they need to be working together to be able to overcome the stuff that's oppressing them.
Mm-hmm. I hate all this construction sound. I'm so sorry.
And it started up right after we started talking.
Yeah, it did. Let me pause for a second so we can talk about this. All right, so we moved to Cynthia Brown's house on Ward Street. What's your address, 1920? Mm-hmm. Dang, I can't remember. Can't believe I remember that. So 1920 Ward Street, a little quieter here. So so let's just pick up where we left off. You were talking about working with a group, and not just a group, but in society at large, kind of the issues of people of color and white folks working together. How possible is it? What does it look like? What are the barriers to it? So what were you just
saying? Well, let me say that, you know, when I think about my orientation to the world, because I wasn't a child of the 60s, but what I remember was this feeling that the 60s was about something exciting, about change and possibilities of a future where life would be better for African Americans in this country. And it was all an intellectual endeavor. And I mean intellectual from the perspective of it is a matter of my having read that history and being excited about it, but not living actively in that time period so that I got to really understand and have an analysis about the level of inequity. Because the segregated school that I grew up in was a school that was one of my favorite places in my history as a student. Because I remember crying, literally, when they desegregated the schools. I was devastated because I was born in 58, so the desegregation order had probably come years, you know, before. But I actually was going into the fourth grade before I had to go into the fifth grade, before I had to go into a racially integrated classroom. And what that meant was that I would no longer be in a school that had all of the grades, which meant all my relatives were in the same school with me. That is really significant to me because the segregated school I remember is not the school that people talk about pre-Board of Brown versus Board of Education 40 years ago. What I remember was a school system where all of my relatives were there in the same school with me, and I felt very at home. I happened to start school in a brand new school. All of that being said, I was always, as I got older, charged up and excited and wished that I lived in the 60s because I loved that whole idea of radicalism and of challenging the status quo of, you know, fighting for people's rights. Well, I literally was almost an adult when I realized that the civil rights movement as a formal period of time may have been over, but the struggles that the civil rights movement was about were struggles that still needed to be waged. And so through my work with the battered women's movement and ultimately around economic justice and workers' rights, I began to see that these are the same kinds of issues that the civil rights movement was about. And so I grew up and worked in environments where they were very racially integrated. They were environments where we constantly talked about the issue of racism and white supremacy and the need for whites to recognize their privilege. But all of my consciousness around my work was about working with whites as a part of the struggle for justice. And I always encountered people who were black nationalists who talked about building up the community, talked about the evil of whites, talked about the need for us to build our own. And I have recognized that for me, it is not an either-or endeavor. That there are large parts of my time that have to be spent building institutions within the black community for black folks to have the capacity to meet their own needs. Because as long as the system that we operate in operates in a way that is hostile and even violent and, you know, intent on not addressing the needs of black folk, black folk better be thinking about how to meet their own needs. And most ethnic groups do that. Even though I abhor, you know, the Klan and Nazi, you know, white supremacist approach, even their racist activity is about not just killing off other people, but preserving their own. When Latinos come into this community and build their own stores and they build their own institutions, it is about meeting their own needs. And I think African Americans have to be about the business of building their own institutions to meet their own needs, as an alternative to simply keep trying to push against a white supremacist system that's hell-bent on not giving them what they deserve. I do think that because we have tax dollars that go into this system and that we ultimately all need to be operating and coexisting peacefully, that I also want to use part of my time to push against this system to make it transform to be something that meets the needs of everybody who lives in the society. But to me, I've come to the place where I don't see it as an either-or endeavor. And I'm going to tell you that while I have always understood that, no, while I have come to that analysis through my respect and appreciation for my black nationalist friends and comrades, I have really become confirmed in that belief when I watch what happened down in New Orleans during Katrina. Because when it becomes clear to you that you're operating with a government that genuinely cut off people's access to survival, not accidentally, not just because they are poorly organized, but because they actually see African-American people as sacrificial lambs. African-American people first, and then poor people. It's almost hard for me. I've always resisted, as I said, this hierarchy of oppression. But it's clear to me that blacks weren't the only ones who were in New Orleans who were being hurt. But you can't not ignore the primacy or the central role of race in who was being ignored and not prepared for, not supported, not rescued in that tragedy. But clearly, you can't ignore the fact that there were poor white people who were still there too, and that their class played a role in that. But, you know, I guess that where I am is that I never wanted to think that it wasn't possible for us to do this thing with good white folks, you know. And clearly I understand that even with some of the white allies that I've had, that there comes a real limit to how much they really are willing to give up. And I don't think it's necessarily just because they're bad people. I think that it is scary as heck, given how privileged we've grown up in this country, to think about going to the mat and sacrificing everything for what you know is right, if it means that you're going to have to do without basic fundamental needs that you are accustomed to having met. You know, and so I don't beat up on folk. What I do is say that we better be about the business of making sure that we can provide what we need for our community in a real kind of way, because this government structure that we're operating in that really is really based more on profit than it is on humanity is not a government that we can trust to meet our needs from law enforcement to human services, you know, and everything in between. And so it just seems to me foolhardy not to deal with the reality that there have to be institutions built in the black community so that when the government start talking about keeping folks from getting access to water, that we got ways of getting water to people when they need it. That when the government says that it is not going to give food stamps to people, it is eliminating access to public assistance for people who are poor. Now, that is at the same time that you're talking about, eliminating people's legal right to public assistance in times of crisis. It's at the same time that you're eliminating jobs throughout this country in communities all over. And so, you know, I would not want to believe that this is possible, but I believe that, I mean, I can't deny that I believe that there will be a time when black folks will be left, and Latinos and poor whites, if they don't have a way to meet their own needs, they will be left to die. Because that's exactly what happened to people in New Orleans. They were left to die. And every time they organized themselves with all of those people narratives that came out, every time they organized themselves to be able to get access to help, the law enforcement infrastructure, more concerned about the public image of what was happening, would disband them, give them false hope that there was a place that they could go get help, just to disband them so that they wouldn't be able to have access to the media to convey the dire nature of what was happening. And so I'm just pretty clear that if we are not doing what we need to do to build up institutions, the doctors and lawyers in our community have got to understand the importance of being able to have a crisis response to provide legal, medical, and every other kind of need that black folk need. Because if we're not doing that for ourselves, then there are a whole lot of folks that are not going to do it for us. That's not to ignore the good folks who have come from these colleges and universities to do volunteer help. But I'm saying that is not enough. It's not enough. And especially if it happens on a mass scale. And if it happens on a mass scale where these students come from white communities that are working class and poor that are also going to be in a dire strait, they're going to go home before they come to our communities, many of them. And therefore, we better have an infrastructure in place to meet our needs. Because I think that when I say it's going to get worse before it gets better, I think that until people figure out in the most dire crisis that we don't work together, that we all going to die, till people are forced to recognize the reality of that, that we're going to keep operating in our little fiefdoms, in our little islands of race and class and identity. And something else is going to have to push us beyond ourselves to do something that unites us against an oppressive system that don't have no respect for any of us. Just creates an illusion for us that we have more privilege, or gives us a little bit more privilege than the next person, so that we're willing to sacrifice the other, whoever the other is, until, you know, you don't have any choice.
Will you say some more about like your vision of what's needed for, in terms of white people giving up privilege, like you even mentioned resources, and like what, say a little bit more about your, and why a lot of white people get scared when it comes up to a certain point about letting go of some privilege and even down to human needs and resources. Like, what's your thinking around that?
Well, I want to be as concrete as possible, and at the same time, I think it's an insult to white people to try to say what I think their fears are, because I think white people have to speak to that. But at least in some of my experiences, like right now, I am working in a commission with whites who right now, to speak the truth as I see it about some of the things that we're looking at.
Is this the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in
Greensboro? It is, and I'm a little bit hesitant to give too much detail, because for me to give an example, I need to go to something that's uppermost in my mind, and that's in my mind. And so I want to be careful, because we haven't published our final report. I also want to be careful because I don't want to, I know this is going to be public, you know, and I want, and I'm trying to draw from these experiences, but be in a way that I don't, well, whatever it is I'm trying to do, let me try to be as straight as I can about making this point. Because there are people, whites, who are on this commission who I think, and not all whites, but a couple of them, who I think have relationships. These are people who have up in age, who have lived a certain lifestyle their entire life or most of their life, and they have a certain status in their community among whites who think very similar to the way that they do. They are engaged in a process, this Truth and Reconciliation process, where to acknowledge any role that race played in what happened on November 3rd, to acknowledge any role that public institutions played in this, means that you have to challenge people whose respect you want. You have to challenge and risk the loss of relationship and status in the community where these people are your peers, these white privileged leaders of the Greensboro community. Now, how willing are people, even as they see that things are wrong, to risk the loss of those relationships and their status in the community? That's concretely what I'm talking about. But I'm also talking about historically, when people have seen something unjust happening. You're in a workplace. You have a job as a supervisor. You see that racist things are happening. But to say something means you risk either losing your status as a supervisor or your job even, because you know that the culture of that environment is a racist culture that says that people of color don't deserve the same level of dignity and respect. And you know that if you go up against that, you risk job loss. That's what I'm talking about. I ain't mad with folk for really wanting to hold on to that job. But what I am mad with is right now recognizing that sometimes you risk a job for a higher ideal, and that ideal, and see, this is again where my faith in God comes from. You can get another job. You can create a job, but you got to be right. You got to be willing to stand up. And I'm telling you, I know from my own personal experience, it ain't the easiest thing in the world to do. But the bottom line is that we have to get to a place, just like when I was talking about running for office and people saying, I know you're the best candidate, but you can't win. Well, if all the people who said I couldn't win had actually voted for me, I could have won. But we are in this deficit mentality, this fear mode, where our fear of loss ends up dictating that we stand up, or that we not stand up or take risk to stand up for what's right. And so I'm talking about concrete losses that people risk, and being able to say, is this loss a loss that I am willing to suffer for what's right? Understanding that in the long run, that it's a greater benefit for me to deal with this loss than to support a system that, if oppressive to this group of people, could ultimately turn around and be oppressive to me. Because I'm going to tell you something. It is working class white people's willingness to support a system where African Americans and Latinos and other people of color have been, had their, the foot of oppression pressed on their neck. To support that system is why you have a system that has perpetuated itself. So now it is reaching up into the race line, up to white working class people, straight up to white management, straight up to anybody who is not a owner in these companies. To me, it is an and as I talk, I'm beginning to just articulate what I have known in my head but not been able to articulate about the primacy of race in this culture. While I have a hard time talking about a hierarchy of oppression, I can't deny that race is central to all of the other oppressions. And so when you open the door for one group of people to be mishandled, to be abused, to be discriminated against, you leave the door open for that rationale for their oppression to be a rationale for oppression and to be justifying oppression of people throughout the system. And in these same corporate cultures where it has been acceptable to treat people as racist, to overlook people for promotions, to make racial slurs or to do racist epithets and racial, like the little dolls with the little noose hanging around the neck left in people's lockers. Those are the same corporate environments where now people who have college degrees go into those workplaces. They've done all the right things. They've gotten the education. They've worked late at night. And they come in and find out that they're laid off today and rehired as a part-time temporary contract worker the next day. Those things are not disconnected in my mind. And I'm saying that when you don't stand up, you know, like Pastor Neil Mola's thing, you know, you don't stand up for people who the system is coming after. You don't stand up for one group, and before long they'll be coming after you. That's real. That is real. And until we get to a place where we're forced to understand, and I can see that as an ultimate reality. But in the face of that ultimate reality, I can't deny that if black folk are not about the business of meeting the needs of the black community, the descendants of slaves, understanding that their survival depends on being there, creating institutions that meet the need of our people, honey, we ain't going to make it. We are not going to make it, because I just look at how African Americans are treated, and I realize that, you know, it's a distorted picture, but to look in the prison system and to see that 12% of the population is represented by, you know, over 48 or 49% of the population in the prison system is African Americans, to know that, you know, they are arrested more, but it's not because they're committing more crime, it's because of the preferential treatment of the whites versus people of color in that system of arrest, certain kinds of selective prosecution, you know, deals made, that kind of thing. And to look in, you know, who's higher in all of the negative statistics of social well-being, you know, and to see that distorted, you know, or disproportionately impacting people of color, you know, I mean, I don't know that I spoke specifically to your question, but I'm just saying that the reality of what I'm looking at around me indicates that you can't have a one-pronged approach. And certainly, where people are still saying to you that you need to bide your time and you need to give it a chance for the system to be responsive. I mean, to be justifying at this point not being able to find African Americans in top levels of management in companies, to be justified not being able to find adequate resources for African Americans or other people of color or even poor people for affordable housing. I mean, we're in the richest nation in the world. And to even rationalize why not give people decent wages or make sure that they have access to affordable basic necessities, even if you don't increase their income, in the richest nation in the world, there's something fundamentally insane about that. And I just think that there are a lot of us who are lulled into this false sense of security that keeps us from being willing to work together within the races as well as across race lines. And it's that insanity that allows the system to perpetuate itself so out of control, where you have people at the top constantly getting the benefit of our lack of unity and organization.
Do you want to say a little bit more about kind of history of the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission? And I mean, it's the first one in the United States, and you've been a commissioner, they call you, right, since 2004. Do you want to say a little bit more about what that is and what you've learned from it to the point that you're comfortable, since it's still ongoing?
Well, you know, the commission came into being because survivors of November 3rd, 1979 decided that they would work with people throughout the community. 1979. And I'm going to talk about what happened November 3rd, 1979, but I'm saying the commission itself came into being because people who survived that brutal attack are still working with people in the community across various sectors in a project called the Greensboro Community Truth and Reconciliation Project. And that project, as one of its strategies, pulled together this commission, identifying seven people to be commissioners who would look at the sequence of events that led to November 3rd, 1979, the context, the sequence of events on that day, as well as the consequences. The context, sequence, and consequences of November 3rd, 1979. And what actually happened on November 3rd, 1979 really did end up culminating into an explosion that was very volatile and ended up being tragic for five people. But it was something that grew out of activist activity around organizing to challenge racist institution like the Klan. There had been this group called Workers' Viewpoint Organization that was a national organization, as far as I can tell right now, that had made a decision at the national level to call itself the Communist Workers' Party. And so they had this Death to the Klan rally that, as near as I can tell, was about challenging the institution of racism that manifests itself in the Klan. But they said Death to the Klan, and they had this rhetoric that was you know, something that ended up being really volatile and inspired the Klan to come and interrupt an organized, legally licensed rally and march. It was convened at Morningside Public Housing Community in Greensboro. And before they could start their march, while they were still at the rally point, a caravan of Klan Nazis, this is the Klan and Nazis, had come together to challenge this rally. And supposedly they were only going to throw eggs at the group and disrupt the activity. But what they ended up doing was actually saying that they were provoked and defending themselves, and ended up taking guns out of the trunks of their cars and shooting on this rally, killing five Communist Workers Party members. And so the issue for the commission is looking at, again, the sequence of events on that day, what kind of factors contributed to making that thing happen, and what are the consequences. And there has been a severe denial on the part of people throughout that community that race had anything to do with it.
White people and black people?
I think mostly whites. But, I mean, the idea is that this was, first of all, this immediate kind of reaction to suggest that the purpose of this thing was, some people suggest, was just some martyrdom on the part of the Communist Workers Party to try to get publicity and get people to come to the, bring them to their cause. But there was also this whole idea that people started to immediately talk about these being two radical groups who were outsiders, who came into this town and had this cataclysmic explosion and had nothing to do with Greensboro. So the community itself, through the media and through the various political institutions, trying to distance itself from this event. And so just in terms of some preliminary learnings that I can speak to as a part of doing this process, is that when you do a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and you bring people together who are coming across race lines, across gender, across age lines, there's a lot of dynamics that get created just within that group who have no history together. And so just the struggle and personal transformation that's required to be in the room together to talk about difficult issues is an important, you know, kind of learning on my part. This idea that you want to do what you've been mandated to do, and you still want to have a respectful exchange with these people, and you want to be able to speak your mind, but people who you are working with don't have the experience or the comfort level to deal directly with the issue of race. You know, trying to figure out how it is that you prepare people to be in relationship with each other. That is as much a part of this work in my mind as it is the analysis of what happened and to make recommendations. Because that, the whole thing is that it's a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And I think one of the challenges is that people have different definitions of what it means to become reconciled. They have different definitions and thoughts about who it is that needs to become reconciled. But the other thing is that I think that people have this illusion. We had a mandate to do this work in a year with the possibility of a 6-month extension, which meant 18 months. You can't get reconciliation over these kind of issues in 18 months. And I think we've already asked for a little bit more of an extension. So ultimately, it will be close to 2 years anyway. But you can get reconciliation over these lifelong issues that we've been dealing with around race and class and gender and stuff in 2 years. So the most that our commission can do is to do an analysis of what actually happened and what led to it and what the consequences are, but at the same time, looking at what are the recommendations we can make about what individuals, what the community can do to begin to move toward reconciliation. There won't be reconciliation at the end of this process, and I think that being called a Truth and Reconciliation Commission is a misnomer and leads people to think that something's possible that I don't think is possible. So you got the issue around the relationship building between the commissioners. You've got this whole clarity that needs to be sought about what it is we're trying to do and what's realistic about what we can do in terms of uncovering the truth and making recommendations toward reconciliation. This whole process has been really amazing, looking at how institutions, seeing examples, because see, you have this way that you understand that institutions contribute to perpetuating white supremacy and how institutions can let the community down because they become self-perpetuating entities that have their own agenda that is separate from protecting the community. The fact that we have looked at how the police could possibly not have been in a community to support, to protect this community when there were two groups coming together who had had a prior history of conflict with each other, and to have a group like the Klan and underestimate the potential for danger or violence is just absolutely, you know, amazing that you could have an institution that people are supposed to have faith in. People want to be able to believe that they can trust law enforcement to protect them. And then to be looking at situations where they have failed and to know about the fallibility of those institutions. It's just, and to think about right now when the police department in Greensboro is under investigation for a history of stuff that could go back to November 3rd, 1979 and beyond. So just thinking about, I mean, this experience has been about recognizing the imperfection and the outright complicity of our major institutions in creating some of the oppression in our community and the violence in our community. It has been, you know, a challenge to deal with that and to think about how do you approach talking about what the community's role is in doing something about that. How do you talk about reconciling with an institution that is on its own agenda that has very little to do with the community? And the community is who you're asking to be reconciled with these various institutions. The role of the media. I mean, it is amazing to me the kind of control that the media has in controlling what people think about a given situation and how they have the opportunity to raise critical issues, even in the most common everyday language, but they choose to, you know, to cast a certain spin with a certain agenda. And, you know, just thinking about what is that all about? What needs to be done about that? So, you know, the other piece then is how you come up with reasonable and rational recommendations about that come out of the context of this analysis of the truth and has concrete possibility to bring about reconciliation. And then how do you take this report and make it as widely accessible as possible and connect it to enough people who have a commitment to those recommendations becoming real? Because people, you know, produce reports every day, and they end up sitting on a shelf and collecting dust. And so for most of us, if not all of us at the table, we are concerned about maximizing people's access to the report and the recommendations, and then ensuring that we are building a network of organizations and individuals who really want to do something with it so that the possibility that something will happen. But even in this process, to be honest with you, this is one of the places where this question of, is this the right thing to do to work with white folks on some of these issues? Because the compromise that's required to keep them at the table sometimes is too much. You know, and the interesting thing is when I said that the other day, their whole thing was you have a responsibility to yourself and who you represent to then do a minority report. And I think that that's absolutely true. But what doing a minority report does is it prevents the people at the table from stretching themselves beyond what they normally would do or say. And I don't have a concrete example right now because I'm thinking that it would be much more helpful with this point to have a concrete example. But because right now there's a possibility that there are things that we're debating and I don't know the end result. But I would rather that we push ourselves to a genuine consensus rather than a consensus that is a compromise consensus just to make sure that everybody's willing to stay at the table with this final report, you know. And so it's a real struggle because you're coming from two totally different worlds as you discuss some of these issues, you know? So anyway.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it reminds me of something you were just saying a minute ago about a big lesson I've learned in organizing over the years that planning for the follow-up about an event or a process can sometimes be as important, maybe even more important, than just mobilizing mm-hmm. or making the thing happen. But mm-hmm. like the organizing piece on the back end, mm-hmm. you know, once it's done, it's just mm-hmm. another huge chunk of work. And so mm-hmm. thinking about that, anticipating it, budgeting it for it, mm-hmm. building it into, you know, how you Absolutely. Set up a whole process is Absolutely. A real big piece of work. But mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do you think there's a difference between activism and organizing?
Well, I've heard people make distinctions, and I guess I can see a distinction, partly because activism is you're just acting and giving visibility to an issue, and you're maybe doing direct action kinds of activities, whereas organizing is really about building organizations, creating institutions. And frankly, I don't think it's an either-or endeavor to support one strategy versus the other. I think both are important. But I think that ultimately, whatever you're an activist around, if you don't put legs up under it and an organization up under it to pick up, to carry forward an agenda to deal with whatever you are being an activist about, and then ultimately to create institutions to take on new issues as they emerge, that it is a lot less sustainable, I guess is what I'm thinking about, has a lot less continuity in terms of, I mean, I could be an activist and be raising a lot of issues about, you know, the lack of affordable housing, but if there's not some organization that ultimately will push an agenda to try to get a fund to support affordable housing, to organize the people who don't have affordable housing, who is working on a campaign to try to get monies put into a trust fund that helps make housing affordable, whatever it is, if all you're doing is trying to raise people's consciousness and being an activist that's not plugged into a collective, you know, because I think you can be an activist and not have folks behind you. You could just be a spokesperson about an issue, outspoken about it, and be out advocating stuff. I would think that could be an activist. But an organizer is somebody who's not even necessarily the spokesperson. That you may not even see the organizer. The organizer is the one who's mobilizing and then ultimately building an organization with people who then take on this message bringing and the organizing and the work of trying to bring about certain kind of change. So that's kind of the distinction I see. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's anything that I can say bad about being an activist unless you're constantly stirring up stuff and you're not plugging in with somebody who can help make sure that something happens as it relates to the issues that you're raising or agitating about.
How you doing? Do you need a break? You okay?
Mm-hmm,
okay.
Good.
So to back up a little bit, you've been involved with the Latino Community Development Center, right? And the Latino mm-hmm. Credit Union at least since 2000. So why'd you decide to get involved with them?
Well, you know, it's funny because for me, so much of what I've done grows out of relationship. And Yvonne Cojar-Pera had not been in the United States very long when I met him. As a matter of fact, when I met him, he didn't even hardly speak English. He had somebody with him who was translating for him. And my first meeting with him, we sat down and talked about, through a translator, about, you know, kind of what he wanted to do to help El Centro Hispano, which I don't know was even called that at the time, because El Centro used to be a ministry of the Episcopal and the Catholic Church. And so he was going to be taken over for the young man, Paul. You remember him, Paul? I don't remember Paul's last name. It's something started with a V, I think. But anyway, Paul was going to be leaving, and he had been working with the Latino community through this ministry, and he was bringing Yvonne around to meet with various folk because he saw that, I think somebody had decided that they would spin off this ministry and make it an independent organization, and Yvonne would be the person who would end up being the director. Anyway, my involvement with El Centro at its very early beginnings was as the staff person at SEJ, who made sure that a lot of the training that we were doing to build community-based capacity was being, that the Latino group was being invited to those various trainings, and that, you know, I worked with Paul Terranova, that was his name, work with Paul Terranova and Yvonne to understand budgets, to understand fundraising, to identify potential fundraising sources, to help spin this thing off, and then ultimately engage them in like program planning workshops, different things. And so it was out of the work of El Centro in conjunction with El Pueblo and some other folks that the Latino Credit Union was born. And I happened to be on the city council at the time that there was these rash of robberies with Latinos who could not access banking services through the traditional banking community. And because they could not access traditional banking services, they ultimately had to identify new ways for people to be able to bank. And so that's where the Latino Credit Union came from. And ultimately, because of my involvement with Yvonne, with El Centro, with other people in the Latino community, when they ended up forming the Credit Union Advisory Board to review grants, I was selected or asked to be on that.
Stop. I'm sorry. Okay.
So the deal is that I had worked with El Centro, knew Yvonne. Ultimately, because of my involvement, coming to their community forums, when they were inviting in city council representatives, inviting in the police department to raise understanding among public officials about the kinds of violent attacks that were happening because they didn't have access to banking services. So ultimately, out of that organizing, they ended up working with other folks in the community to start the Latino Credit Union. When they started that Latino Credit Union, they asked me to serve on their advisory committee, the loan advisory committee, and I did that. And what that really did was make me realize how I have got to go back and learn Spanish, because I happen to be the only person on the advisory committee who didn't speak Spanish. And so I really need to get, back in track in terms of trying to learn Spanish. But because even when I was working for SCJ, and in the Kellogg Fellowship, there were various times when I was afforded the opportunity to interact with Latinos, even back to the battered women's movement, so that I was always conscious of some of the same kinds of issues affecting the Latino community that were affecting the African-American and other workers. But I also became very conscious as time went on about issues specific to the Latino community. I mean, issues related to immigration, the H-2 worker program, and how workers are brought in from other countries to exploit them as cheaper labor. Going down to Juarez, Mexico, I went to Taos, New Mexico, and then El Paso, Texas, visiting with Kellogg Fellows and looking at issues in that environment. And when I was in El Paso, I happened to be introduced to an organization that was doing a lot of work with immigrant workers and did a lot of work with workers who were coming across the border and being exploited by contractors who were taking the Latinos into the fields, and just looking at the working conditions, looking at the work arrangements that made them vulnerable as workers, and then becoming very conscious of the kind of impact that U.S. corporations were having on the economy in Mexico that ended up literally forcing Latinos over the border into the United States looking for better wages. Better than what were being paid in Mexico, but much lower than what was being paid to U.S. workers, which created a really bad kind of dynamic. Looking at issues as it related to the spraying of the fields and the toxins that were compromising the health of Latino workers. So over the years, I've just had various connections that then made me, connect to this question of making sure that the Latino community had access to resources to build up that community the same way that I looked at, any other workers in the community.
And in 2003, you became a founding member of the North Carolina Coalition on Black and Brown Civic Participation, right? Mm-hmm. So tell me, and Brown there means Latino only?
It was primarily looking at Latino community. But that is an organization that actually was formed, should be active now, but I actually ended up by default formulating that organization, and there was not enough real concrete support for that organization to exist beyond the election cycle that we were in. And we didn't form it just because of that election cycle, but the excitement and the resources to support it happened to be around the excitement about trying to mobilize people to participate in that election that year. But since then, because of my business, because of my role in the commission, I haven't been able to do anything with it. And so it really is basically an organization that's on hold. But the goal was to help bridge an alliance between African American and Latino voters so that they could, one, become more informed about the electoral process and better equipped to participate in it, but also to build alliances across issues that were impacting both communities, and to strengthen the relationship in a way that didn't allow people outside of the community to exploit our differences and our language barriers and whatnot, so that we could be pitted against each other. But it was all about civic participation as a core kind of issue towards some of those other broader goals.
Mm-hmm. And you were also, you've also been involved in the campaign finance reform movement. You served on the board of was Democracy South and now Democracy North Carolina for a long time, huh? Mm-hmm. Did you get involved with those issues when you were on the Durham City Council? When did you first get involved with that? And
honey, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know, you know, because I was connected to the Institute for Southern Studies when it was just an idea to form Democracy South, and then was not formally involved, I don't think, when the split happened between Democracy South and then Democracy North Carolina was formed, but ultimately was recruited to serve on the board of Democracy North Carolina. And once again, you know, it's all about relationship. I mean, people ask you, and if there are people you know and like and respect their work, Bob Hall is somebody I've known for a long time. Carrie Bolton was involved in the board. She was somebody I'd known for a long time. Peter I knew, you know, and probably met through the work, Peter Walls. And so there were various people who were encouraging me to get on the board, so I got on there because of them, you know, had very little to do. I mean, I understood the issue, but it wasn't my issue of the day. But, you know, over time, as you begin to really become clear about the role of money in politics, it's clear that you can only organize so many people in the community to fight a system and have any impact if the way that is the machinery is greased with that money is not changed. So, you know, I've had limited involvement primarily on the boards of these organizations and supporting the program that they have. But beyond that, I can't say that I've actually been out here knocking on doors and organizing around that issue, but certainly supporting other people's efforts to organize around that issue.
That reminds me, I meant to ask you, in the U.S., the Democratic primary campaign, you said you raised, you know, near $50,000. What was the average amount that Bowles and...
I told you, I don't know what the average number was, but I know that there were hundreds of thousands of dollars raised. Like, maybe, I want to guesstimate that Elaine Marshall had close to $500,000. I don't know how much Blue did, but I would say his approached $500,000, but closer to $300,000. Guesstimating, because these numbers are coming out of the air, but they're rooted in some memory. And then I know Bowles raised over $1 million, you know, and so that's why I'm saying with those kind, I mean, $300,000 is nothing to sneeze at when all you raise is under 50. So, you know, what I could have done with $300,000, honey, was possibly win. Because the key thing is people using money for name recognition, signs and commercials and those things that would help put their name on people's mind when they go, you know, vote. But the other piece is paying people to actually be out in the community knocking doors and working polls on election day. And needless to say, I wouldn't say this about any of my competitors in that race, although you might be able to assume that some money was being used to buy votes, you know, but I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that about those candidates in particular, but certainly that's what some of the money goes to in these campaigns, you know.
So what are some other political issues you've been involved with over the years that we hadn't touched on yet?
I don't know. I mean, like I said, I've mentioned a lot of them, and it takes one of these kinds of conversations for me to remember how many issues, campaign finance reform, anything dealing with workers' rights, workers' health and safety, you know, living wage, minimum wage. It's amazing to me. I didn't even realize I had been connected to this many issues. Getting, you know, women access to jobs and non-traditional jobs, you know, going all the way back to women's opportunity and road construction kind of work, battered women's issues. You know, I have not been as involved, but have been deeply concerned and have supported other allies who are working on issues connected to the prison industry complex. Because I don't see what's happening around the growth of prisons, separate and apart from the kind of crazy approaches that we have to economic development in our communities, where you build a prison and end up, you know, with a lot of industry going inside prison, and a community where people are losing jobs left and right, and they're law-abiding citizens who need a way to support their families, exploiting, you know, the labor of prisoners, you know, to the sacrifice of people having jobs in the community is crazy. But, you know, this whole idea that these prisons are not separate and apart from people who advocate for three strikes, you're out, so that you can have a lifetime supply of labor locked up in these prisons. And the idea that you have people who own the prisons, who not only own the prisons, but actually have connections to or own the security contracts for those prisons and the food contracts for those prisons, so that it's an industry. It's based on more on profit and people making a living off of, you know, this system than it does to do with protecting the public. So that's not an issue I've worked on as much, but something that I have been very concerned about and supported other folks in doing. I'm tired.
You're getting tired. Okay, so you want two more little questions?
Okay.
What's next for you? What's next for you?
That's a good question. I don't know. You know, I do believe that I will get involved in electoral politics again. I am struggling right now about the time that it takes to engage in electoral politics. And the amount of money it takes, the time, and the fact that I keep trying to figure out if that's the best use of my time and talent, given all the needs that our community has. So, you know, I'll continue working with the Conservation Fund, which is one of my biggest clients, that's working with people to look at economic development that adheres to principles around environmental justice, or environmental conservation, social justice, and economic development. Economic development that is based on the asset of natural resources in your community. So people are talking about things like ecotourism, heritage and cultural tourism, looking at environmentally sensitive kinds of development. So just the idea that I will continue to work with groups through the Sojourner Group to strengthen their capacity and to build their consciousness about the political environment that we're operating in, which mitigates against really trying to do holistic development that pays attention not just to the flora and the fauna and the air, land, air, and water, but also to the people in that environment. And to constantly work in different ways to keep people from buying into the notion that you got to sacrifice your environment to have a decent job. Looking at supporting the development of institutions in the African-American community so that the needs of African-American people can be met, whether or not this government is standing or not. You know, I think that the government that we are operating under is set to self-destruct. I think it's set to self-destruct because you cannot mete out the level of misery and the level of invasion in people's humanity. And I'm saying invasion because I'm thinking about this whole idea that you don't have civil liberties, this idea that you don't have the right to privacy, the idea that you don't have the right to have secret and quiet, you know, protected communication with your attorney, all of that stuff that was in the Patriot Act, this unchecked ability of the law enforcement to invade our lives and to control our communities, and to have basic necessities that people need being cut off from communities. I just think that the system is set up to self-destruct, and so people like myself have to continue to be positioned to be a part of that same voice that leads people when the explosion happens. I literally believe that if we don't do things differently, that people are going to be fighting in the street. And that terrifies me if I tell the truth about it. But I don't know how you get people re-engaged in this system so that things turn around until that crisis comes. And that's a scary thing. It may not come in our lifetime, but I think it's coming because the system is too out of whack. It's too unbalanced at this point. And it's too many people vulnerable as a result of the way that our economic, political, and social structure is shaped. So, you know, I'll be doing more of the same, and who knows, at different points in my life, I'll be emphasizing different things.
Seems to be the way it goes with organizing. Is there anything we hadn't talked about over the last few times that you want to touch on, or big chapters of your life where I didn't ask about or left out that feel important to you?
Girl, it might be, but I can't think of it, because at this point, I must have talked to you in this concentrated period of time about more things than I talked to anybody at one time. A chance to hit the tapes, and it didn't occur to me until earlier today that by doing 3 tapes with you, that I got to listen to 3 or read through extensive transcripts to be able to make sure that I'm conveying what it is I really want to convey. So
yeah, another several hours of work, a little piece of work there. So real. I really appreciate it. It's good for the project. All right, that's good. Let's end here, okay?
Sounds good.
Thank you, Ms. Cynthia Brown.